From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And from our team to yours, however big or small this year, happy Thanksgiving. Thanks for listening in. And on this Thanksgiving Day, some religious groups in New York are celebrating last night's rare late-night Supreme Court decision, blocking an executive order from New York Governor Andrew Cuomo that restricted attendance at religious services in their neighborhoods because of the pandemic. Ultra-Orthodox Jewish organizations in Brooklyn and Queens and the Roman Catholic Diocese of Brooklyn claim that Cuomo singled them out. The state pointed to the recent spike in COVID-19 cases. And then there was that alarming ultra-Orthodox wedding last week that drew hundreds not wearing masks. The court's decision was 5-4, with its newest justice, Amy Coney Barrett, considered the fifth vote. Emily Bazelon, staff writer at New York Times Magazine and fellow at the Yale Law School, is here. Emily, thank you for taking a break from your Thanksgiving. Thanks.
You are welcome. Glad to be here.
And we should say the two litigants, the ultra-Orthodox Jewish groups and the Catholic diocese, were already not subject to these restrictions because they've been lifted. There's a color system for restrictions in New York, and COVID cases had abated in their area. But what was the argument from the court in blocking even targeted restrictions?
Well, the court was arguing that New York hadn't shown that less strict measures would be enough to protect public health, which is a pretty cursory kind of way of thinking about this. You can see in the concurrences by Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh that some of the conservative judges didn't like the idea that essential businesses, which were permitted to open in New York, included stores, but did not include houses of worship. And I think the odd thing about the majority's analysis here is what it's comparing. So the majority behaves as if people going to stores are the same as people congregating in a house of worship, even though it's very unusual in a store for lots of people to be sitting together or certainly singing or chanting together for a long time. That's right. Traditional in a church or synagogue or a mosque, and we know that that is a riskier activity. So there was no discussion of the science or kind of scientific public health considerations in the majority's opinion.
Yeah. And what about Chief Justice John Roberts and the three liberal justices dissenting? What did they say?
Well, Chief Justice John Roberts says, you know what, there's no reason for us to decide this right now. For the reason that you gave earlier, New York had agreed to lift these restrictions for now because the coronavirus spread is not as bad in the city. And so these restrictions said that in the red zone, the highest risk in New York, you could have 10 people in a house of worship. In the orange zone, you could have 25 people. But the Catholic Archdiocese and the Orthodox synagogues that have sued, they no longer are subject to those restrictions. And so Chief Justice Roberts was making a kind of traditional conservative judicial modesty move here in which he's saying, look, if they're subject to these restrictions again, maybe they will be proved to be unduly harsh. But at the moment, they're not. So we don't need to step in here. And this is a classic example of a judge saying, you know what, let's leave this in the hands of public health officials, not have judges step in to make these decisions unless it's absolutely necessary.
Well, and be clear, what does it mean? I mean, be clear only because I'm not able to figure this out. Temporary decision made on an emergency basis. By the way, when Ruth Bader Ginsburg was on the court, Roberts sided with the liberals and the decision was in favor of restrictions. That was when California had restrictions in place. So obviously there's been a tilt here. But what does this mean for other states, for New York, when it comes to restrictions on houses of worship in the pandemic?
Yeah, I'm kind of scratching my head about that too. I mean, it looks like what the court is saying is that if you have businesses open, you have to treat churches and other houses of worship just like those businesses, but without paying attention to the greater risk that the church, that, you know, a religious service can entail. And that's very strange to me, because it seems so at odds with the science and what we know about the spread of coronavirus. And so you're right, this is a decision that's a temporary restraining order against New York. The merits, the kind of larger case, is still to be thrashed out in the lower courts. And so one hopes going forward that there will be more attention to these apples to apples comparisons and figuring out what the state really needs to do to protect public health.
And meanwhile, many have seen the video from the Hasidic wedding in Brooklyn this month, hundreds packing a synagogue, no one wearing masks. Mayor Bill de Blasio said organizers will be fined. $15,000 for violating restrictions. And so we're keeping an eye on that to see what happens there, if there might be any kind of consideration of that. Emily Bazelon, staff writer at the New York Times Magazine, fellow at the Yale Law School. Thank you so much for weighing in on this Supreme Court decision. Thank you.
Thanks, Robin. Happy Thanksgiving.
You too. Well, we've been following the conflict in Ethiopia, where today Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed ordered his army to launch an assault on the capital of the Tigray region, Mekelle. He'd given the Tigray People's Liberation Front, which controls the capital, a deadline to surrender. That passed yesterday, and the group vowed to keep fighting. The BBC's Kalkadan Yipbeltal joins us from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia's capital, by Skype. Kalkadan, I know it's very difficult to get information from this region because the communications have been cut. But can you tell us more about what's been happening?
Indeed, it's been very difficult to get independent and credible information. But from what we can piece together, we understand that the fighting is still going on. It's more than 3 weeks now. And by now, hundreds of fighters from both sides are believed to have been killed. There is also a tremendous amount of staggering number of civilian casualties. More than 40,000 people have already crossed borders and are seeking refuge in neighboring Sudan. There's also believed to be a high number of internally displaced people within Ethiopia. So a few days ago, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed announced a 3 days ultimatum for fighters in the Tigray state to surrender peacefully. But leaders of the group that leads the Tigrayan state rejected the call, and they said that they're going to fight till the end and pay the necessary sacrifice. So today he said that what he calls a final phase of the military operation has been launched. So we're expecting more of the fighting and, sadly, more of the tragic news of the humanitarian cost of this conflict.
Well, and we want to ask you more about why Prime Minister Ahmed, a Nobel Peace Prize winner, might be doing this. But first, remind us what the Tigray People's Liberation Front, the TPLF, is fighting for.
The TPLF, it has been the dominant political force in Ethiopia's politics for close to three decades, starting from the early 1990s. But that ended in 2018 when the current Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed came to power, and they felt sidelined by the new Prime Minister, and they rejected joining his party, his ruling party, that he was restructuring and rebranding in his vision. And then they called him illegitimate after an election that was meant to happen last August didn't happen. The election was postponed due to the COVID-19 pandemic, but the TPLF accuses the prime minister of using the pandemic as a pretext to stay in power illegally. And they conducted their own regional election in September, which the federal government and the prime minister deemed illegal. After that, each side accused the other side of being illegitimate, and things escalated. And early in November, fighting broke out when the federal government here in Addis accused the Tigray fighters, the TPLF, of attacking a military base that was in Tigray. And now we are seeing more of this fighting.
Well, as we mentioned, the Prime Minister received the Nobel Peace Prize for ending Ethiopia's war with Eritrea, now fighting a civil war in his own country against his own people. But does he also have popular support?
The Prime Minister, as you said, won the Nobel Peace Prize last year for ending a 20-year-old war with neighboring Eritrea. But as I said earlier, he had problems with the Tigrayan party, this Tigrayan party, since he came to power. And what he's arguing is that for the past 2.5 years, he and his government has been trying repeatedly to bring the TPLF to the table and to solve any disputes on the round table. And now, with the alleged attack on the military base there, a red line has been crossed, and the only way to end this conflict is to bring what he calls criminals to justice. After this military operation was begun, it seems that in the rest of the country, it has a wide support, and it helped the prime minister regain some of the support that he was losing. Partly because when the TPLF was a dominant force in Ethiopia and when they were the major player in Ethiopian politics in the government, there have been a lot of resentment against them, a lot of complaints about human rights abuses and economic and political marginalization. So now it seems that some people want to see some of the members of this party brought to justice. But unfortunately, there is a high number of civilians caught in the conflict, and that's very saddening. And a lot of people seem to be concerned about that.
Yeah, well, we're hearing terrible, terrible stories of the violence there. The BBC's Kalkadan Yibbutal in Ethiopia. Thank you so much for checking in with us.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
COVID-19 has forced many of us to rely on old memories this Thanksgiving, since we can't make new ones. So here's one of mine. At this point, many of you tell us it's one of yours too. Our annual re-airing of my pilgrimage to see the migrating snow geese in Vermont with my late uncle Lachlan McLaughlin Field. At the time, Uncle Lach was 88 and starting a battle with Alzheimer's. It's a trip I couldn't make now. I'm so glad I made then.
The snow geese, thousands of them, touch down every fall at a refuge called Dead Creek. My Uncle Locke had taken me there once to see the brown Canadian geese, but I wanted to see the snows. My cousin Peggy kept writing this fall, telling me that the snows had arrived. Finally, I got the subtext of her postcards. The leaves were falling. The snow geese would soon be leaving. And at 88, it's not like my uncle was going to wait around forever either. So up to Vermont we went.
Uncle Locke?
Yo!
Hi!
Hello!
We should go see the geese while we can.
Yeah. Okay, I'll go with you.
My uncle, Lachlan McLaughlin Field, looms large in my branch of the family. We were from the suburbs of New York. He collected arrowheads and with his son carved duck decoys. He and my late Aunt Martha spent years in the war, then came to Middlebury where he taught high school art. To us, he was General Patton meets Norman Rockwell.
I can't drive the car anymore, so I'm stuck here. I haven't been out of this. I haven't seen it. You're the first person I've seen in this house in 2 weeks.
No.
That's true.
Well, hardly. Cousin Peggy and her family live just down the road. It's just that at 88, Uncle Locke recently had to give up cross-country skiing. He's not painting as much. We went into his artist retreat to gather up the things we needed to birdwatch, binoculars, and telescopes.
I love all this military stuff you have framed up here.
Things like that. It's a big deal because I got that out of the house in a crawl space over in Middlebury Way.
Yeah. And what is it, a U.S. mail pouch?
That thing, Civil War. It's a cartridge box and bayonet.
A cartridge box and a bayonet. Look at that.
Place is a mess.
No, I love it.
I don't work out here. That's why I'm sort of sit around, vegetate.
Not today. We're going to geese.
Now, I know that life here in Middlebury, Vermont isn't exactly quaint. This is a college town. But I love being here, where the silence is broken only by us.
She's a pro. What, in case someone steals it?
When was the last time you heard an alarm up here?
I got it.
So, off to Dead Creek, about a 20-minute drive from Middlebury. And on the way, we would do what relatives do this time of year, whether convening to go see a bird or to eat one. We just talked.
Ah, so, have you been following all the news? You know, all the fighting in Afghanistan and...
Yeah, well, I'm going to tell you something. At my age, all I can remember is fighting. It's been going on for years. Slow down, because you're going to go across the traffic that goes that way. You go straight.
Okay. Didn't you fight in the Battle of the Bulge?
Well, yeah, me and several hundreds of thousands of other people.
Yeah, I didn't think you were there by yourself.
Yeah, all alone, I held them up. Yeah, that was sort of cold weather. A lot of snow.
Tell me about Dead Creek. I've been trying to explain it, that it's sort of a resting place where the migratory birds?
Yeah, there's a lot of water over there, and it's right on the big flyway from north to south. So they flock in there. Apparently, a lot of stuff that they like to eat. And I've seen geese there you wouldn't believe, but no guarantee this time that they're there. See, the weather's getting colder and they're going to hang around.
I know.
They're going to bug off down south.
Yeah.
They go through sometimes in by the thousands. I saw one time I walked out in the backyard and snow geese were going by. They were low, very, very, very low, and they were way back of the house. They were flying single file. And I bet you the line of them was probably 3 football field length.
Really?
Low. So I got big. I watched this big chain going. It's up over the top of the trees, down, down, down. Never ever seen it since.
Huh.
Sometimes you can hear them coming, all honking away. Oh, oh, oh. Sound exactly like that, if you want to know.
They do. Okay, Uncle Locke, we just saw a sign, Dead Creek Wildlife Management. And the good news is I see some cars up ahead. I see.
There's a lot of times the geese get out in there. See?
Okay.
Right. There they go. See them?
Yep.
Uh-huh. Oh.
All right, now
look at the cars here.
I know.
Well, that means a lot of geese. Look at them out there. See them?
Yep. Let's go up there. Oh, look, there's geese!
At Dead Creek, we met up with my cousins and Brian Pfeiffer, a member of the Vermont Audubon Society, who runs several bird tours.
This is a refuge for them. They can't be hunted here.
Oh, man.
And they know that they can't be hunted here. I mean, these geese are really smart. All around this refuge, sort of beyond the perimeter of what we can see, are hunters with decoys and weapons loaded, you know, for these birds. There are at least 3 different kinds of geese here. Obviously, we see lots of snow geese here. Canada geese are here, but also we're seeing regularly Ross's goose. It's a small version of a snow goose. They have a bluish base at the bill, whereas, you know, snow goose has that black grin patch, you know, where the upper and lower mandibles meet. And people think that we're nuts, you know, because we come out here and we look at all these snow geese. But I've spent days out here when I've looked at every single snow goose that I could find. I may look at 10,000 geese looking for one Ross's goose. It's also
name that thing again.
Ross's, R-O-S-S.
Ross's.
R-O-S-S apostrophe S.
Yeah, okay.
Ross's goose.
Goose, huh? Yeah.
Small. They're out here.
I want to see one now.
Yeah,
see,
so do I.
Yeah. Hey, but look, I'm looking up there. I'm way up, much higher than the others we've seen. There's a V forming. Are they leaving?
Those birds appear to be leaving. Also, if you look right over the parking lot here, is a bird that's hovering. That's a red-tailed hawk hovering. But yes, those birds are leaving. You notice the V formation?
Yeah.
You see how one arm of the V is longer than the other?
Yeah.
They've actually figured out why that is, why one arm is longer than the other. The longer arm has more geese in it.
Oh my gosh! Hundreds, thousands of them! Uncle Locke, look! Thousands!
Around! Yeah!
Oh, maybe they'll come this way! Here they come!
Wow, that's why I look at them!
I will never forget the look on my uncle's face. He'd put on my cousin's cape because of the cold, and when the birds rose up, probably because of that hawk, so did he. It was as if the ground where the snow geese were had been covered with snow, and then someone scooped it all up and threw it in the air like confetti.
Gliding down. See how they're starting to glide as the wind's coming at them?
I hear some more. Stragglers.
Okay. Heading north, not south.
I know, it's the wrong way. Go back.
I mean, I think that these geese are one of the great natural events in all of New England. You know, you can think of all the great things that happen in New England, like, I don't know, you know, movement of whales off the coast or spotted salamanders going to vernal pools in the spring. But these geese are just one great fall experience. And you had it. I mean, when they all flew over your heads, you know. I mean, that's just, I live for that every fall.
But I saw the snow geese one time going by down through Cornwall.
Yeah.
Looked out back, and it was nothing but a thin white line.
Yes.
As far as you could see, and tree height. As yeah. far south as you see, yeah. and far north. Just yeah. one long column of them.
Yeah.
Must be thousands of them. Okay.
Well, thank you so much, Brian.
Okay. Sure.
We're getting frozen.
That's right. Let's go.
What'd you think?
Think about what?
The geese.
Oh, pretty nice, yeah. I've seen millions of them, you know.
I know you have. But I saw the look on your face when that group lifted up and took off.
Oh, it's tremendous, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. With weather like this, they'll be taken off out of here. They'll be gone.
Yeah.
When they go, it's like turning the light off. They're gone.
Okay. When you want to get something to eat?
You want to get something to eat?
Yeah.
Not particularly. Why, you?
Yes, I do.
A return visit to the Snow Geese of Vermont with my late uncle, Lachlan McLaughlin Field, who passed away in 2004 at the age of 91. I think of him often, especially when I see a line of geese stretched across the sky.
A thin white line, as far as you can see, and tree height. Just yeah. one long column of them. When they go, it's like click, turning the light off. They're gone.
Support for this podcast comes from the Boston Foundation. A resilient city and region relies on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve Greater Boston's most serious problems, from the hardships of COVID to the fight for racial equity and other important issues that affect the lives of everyone in our community. Learn how you can help build a Greater Boston that works for everyone by partnering with the Boston Foundation at tbf.org/partner.
The sound of the Macy's Day Parade, which rolled ahead today, sort of. The route was one block long, not 2 miles. There were 12 giant balloons, not 16, far fewer handlers, and much of what you might have seen was actually pre-taped in advance for social distancing. But since 1924, the parade has only been canceled 3 times during World War II, and New York City evidently decided a global pandemic was not about to be the fourth. Julia Jacobs covered the parade's changes this year for the New York Times. Julia, happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you. Thanks for having me.
Well, was it, you know, as you watched, or was it sort of kind of anemic?
Well, you could tell that this was not a normal year, but they did a good job of, I think, making an illusion of a seamless parade. I mean, you know, the people I was watching with could not tell that most of it had been pre-taped. The biggest kind of deflating piece of it was that there were no crowds of children, crowds of people bundled up, sipping hot cocoa. There was just not that sort of excitement that there is in past years.
Well, no spectators, and such a shame because it's kind of warm there, so they wouldn't have been freezing. But no marching bands? What are some of the other differences?
Right. A big part of the parade is that high school and college marching bands fly in from around the country, and that just can't happen this year. So instead, they put in acts from different parades in New York City that have been canceled. And the biggest change, I think, in terms of numbers is usually you have 8,000 workers on the parade route, crowded together. But this year, it is 88% reduced. So you have 960 people spread across over 3 days. Mm. And you also have little vehicles driving the balloons instead of hundreds of people. So rather than 100 people per balloon, you're getting just 25.
Yeah. And these balloon handlers realized they couldn't use their whistles, which direct the balloons, you know, tell people what they need to do, because of masks. So they used electric handheld whistles. But you mentioned that there were people from other parades that had been canceled. The West Indian American Day Parade, the St. Patrick's Day Parade, the Pride Parade, the Mermaid Parade from Coney Island. They all had these floats and things. But was anybody critical of, well, gee, how come their parades got canceled, but Macy's didn't and you're folding them in? Or did people realize this is the only safe way for everyone to be in a parade?
I didn't see much of that criticism, but you could tell that Macy's suspected that there might be some, which is why perhaps they invited these acts from the other parades. And the criticism that I'm seeing coming from people is, why are we doing this at all when, you know, we have a second wave that is clearly bearing down on New York City? And, you know, Macy's and NBC have taken tons of precautions and they've been working with the city and the state constantly for months. But for some people, that risk is just too much. Mm.
Understandable criticism. I'm also thinking of families who've been at home with, you know, five kids. They had something to do, even if it was, as you said, deflated. Julia Jacobs from the New York Times on today's Macy's Day Parade. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
One of the most profound stories we heard this year was about the Iraqi parents in a little town outside Mosul whose teenage son had run away to join ISIS. We listened, as they listened for the first time, to a recording of him on Iraqi TV, lying on the ground, seriously wounded. It's him, she says. Right after that video, he was handed over to Navy SEAL medics. Soon after that, he was stabbed and died. That recording, maybe his last words. And his death would become the center of the war crimes trial of Navy SEAL Eddie Gallagher, who was charged with premeditated murder in the stabbing, cleared in court when another SEAL claimed responsibility, and then Gallagher was supported and eventually granted clemency for a lesser charge by President Trump. But through all of this, no one notified the boy's parents until NPR's Jane Arraf tracked them down. Jane Arraf has been reporting from the Middle East for NPR since 2016. Next month, she starts a new job as the New York Times Baghdad bureau chief. And today she opens her reporter's notebook for us. And Jane, start with that high-profile trial. What questions did you have?
So my questions really were, you know, we've heard so much about Eddie Gallagher, the Navy SEAL who was accused, but we heard hardly anything, not even the name of that wounded ISIS fighter, a teenager who was lying there interviewed by Iraqi TV and then ended up dead in the hands of the Navy SEALs.
And so you and a producer did what? Like try to track him down? You didn't have a name.
I was working with our fixer, Sangar Khalil, and he managed to find who the fighter was. There was no body. His body was left there and then dumped in a mass grave. We can't know 100% for sure that this is his identity, but the family was convinced that that was their son.
And what was his name?
His name was Khalid Jamal Abdullah, and the name he took on was Ahmed from Shura. Shura was the village near Mosul that he came from.
Right, where you tracked down his family. And where, in our mind's eye, he suddenly gets reduced to this teenager, you know, disobeying his father who didn't want him to go off. He joined ISIS. They paid him $50 a month. And then he came back and told his parents that, in fact, he couldn't quit because they'd kill him. And his parents told you what? This had kind of destroyed them.
Yeah, you know, when he was interviewed by the Iraqi television reporter, this teenager who was lying there wounded with his leg bandaged, and he said, "Why did you join ISIS?" And the boy said, "I joined because they told me Afya." Afya is a word that means good job, you know? And he also said, "My father beat me to keep me from joining." So we went to the father who was working in a shop behind the counter. And he looked at the video and he was almost expressionless, except at the point where the boy said, "My father beat me to keep me from joining," you could see a tear rolling down his face. The father actually tried physically to go to get him back and was told by ISIS that once you join ISIS, you don't unjoin. The father seemed to have done everything he could to keep this from happening. And he actually said to his son, "You will destroy us. You will destroy this family."
You know, I'm hearing so much legwork, but I'm also hearing how much of a story there is behind a story, which is the work that you do. I mean, I'm thinking of another story ISIS attacked the minority Yazidi in Iraq. You met a mother who believes her husband and son were killed. She saw her 13-year-old daughter assaulted right in front of her. And a 4-year-old daughter was ripped from her arms. Terrible. This mother made her way to Canada. And then you met up with her when she came back to an orphanage in Mosul in Iraq, because the thinking was that a now 10-year-old girl might have been that 4-year-old ripped away from her. We're waiting on a DNA test.
I mean, this story is extraordinary. It's the kind of thing that you could make a movie of, right? But the thing to remember and the thing that's so astounding is almost everyone has a story like this. This is a very small and ancient ethnic minority that ISIS declared genocide against. There's almost no family that lived in Sinjar that has not been affected by this. But she's facing all of this by coming back. And there's just this incredible understated bravery. And part of the poignancy of this to me was she had her 2 sons with her. They're 6 and 8 year old. They've been in Canada for 3 years. They speak English really well. They kind of understood why they were there, but not really. And just the gap between these kids who are rapidly becoming Canadian and their mother, and they don't even share really a language they're all fluent in anymore, was just so huge.
Jane Aref, what does this say to you? Because, you know, these stories are riveting, but many Americans are looking in another direction, at other movies, you know? We're not as focused at all on this region. We remember the U.S. invaded Afghanistan in 2001 to avenge the Saudi Osama bin Laden's attack on 9/11. Iraq was attacked in 2003 based on faulty intelligence. And here we are. What is it you would want Americans to know that you're seeing that maybe we're not about this region?
All of us who cover the region and all of us who cover Iraq in particular share that worry that Americans aren't invested anymore in Iraq. It was 17 years ago that the U.S. invaded Iraq, and there's an entire generation in Iraq, as well as obviously in the United States, that doesn't remember any of it. But after that, you know, as the country slid into civil war and then further sectarian fighting, and then there was al-Qaeda, and then there was ISIS, Iraqis who used to blame the U.S. for pretty much everything started blaming their own leaders. So I would hope that Americans don't stop paying attention to Iraq and what's happening there. But Iraq has kind of moved on a lot since 2003.
No. What about the broader region? You're speaking with us from Cairo. Everyone remembers the promise of the Arab Spring in 2011. It was not fulfilled. We're also coming off a year in which the Trump administration forged agreements, historic agreements, between Israel and the United Arab Emirates. What are you looking at?
Well, part of it is near term. Part of it is how does a Biden administration affect things in Saudi Arabia, for instance, which under the Trump administration has been incredibly cozy with that country, even after the killing and dismemberment of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. I'll be looking at whether the relationship cools with Egypt, which gets a lot of U.S. aid and military assistance and has pretty much been given a pass on what's been an escalating crackdown on human rights. But, you know, the question of Iraq has really always been, will this country hold together? Will it remain stable? But now the question is more, can it fulfill the incredible potential it has? You know, the young people, the talent, the oil reserves it has, all of the things that have so far not contributed to a country that is stable and successful.
Jane Aref, before coming to NPR, you had 2 decades of reporting from this region, CNN, NBC, the Christian Science Monitor, PBS NewsHour. You were at one point the only Western journalist in Baghdad covering the war in Iraq and covering live battles in Fallujah. I mean, just incredible work. Also in India, Pakistan, Haiti, Bosnia. You'd be forgiven if at this point you said, you know, I think I'm going to go to an island with you know, beach umbrellas. You're staying for the New York Times in the region. Why? What's the draw?
You know, the draw first was I wanted to see what happened. You know, that curiosity we all have as journalists. How is this going to end? Right. I had felt I didn't want to leave Iraq when things were bad. That's not something that I think one should do. And now I'm kind of, I can't really quite decide what I think will happen in Iraq. But what I know is that I want to be there to cover it and to do stories of these people who otherwise would die nameless, or these incredible, courageous women who come back to try to put pieces of their family together. They keep trying. And I think the least that we can do as journalists is to cover them.
Well, Jane Arraf, we should also mention you have such a distinctive voice, always measured, always bringing dignity to whatever you're seeing. And we hope to hear your voice on Here Now for years to come. NPR's Jane Arraf, soon to be the New York Times Jane Arraf, the new Baghdad bureau chief. Jane, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin. Thank you.
Happy Thanksgiving, although this year for many that means little tiny turkeys for two, football with no fans pouring beer on each other. That actually sounds pretty great. There were supposed to be three pro football games today in Detroit, Dallas, and Pittsburgh, but the Steelers game against the Baltimore Ravens has been moved to Sunday after positive COVID-19 tests. In Massachusetts, Thanksgiving has been a day of high school rivalry games, some schools playing each other for more than 100 years. None of those games will be played today. The entire high school football season was canceled because of COVID-19. Mike Pesk is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. So, Mike, happy Thanksgiving, but now the segment ends because I don't think we have anything to talk about.
Well, just, I'm here, you know.
You're
I've
here.
I've not been ruled out, so that's something.
No. Did you have a Thanksgiving football tradition growing up?
I grew up in one of the least football-heavy places, Long Island, but friends and I would play two-hand touch football until it became hard two-hand touch, until as adults there was something like a 60% injury rate, so we canceled the game.
I have to say, you know, I'm a fellow Long Islander, and, you know, yeah. No, we didn't, but we were really good at lacrosse. Anyway, moving on,
exactly.
The NFL has these games today. The season will continue this weekend, but tell us more about pro football dealing with COVID-19.
Yes, as you said, there was an outbreak among Ravens players, so they were able to move that game back. And so what we have are the two traditional teams who for years and years always played on Thanksgiving. The Cowboys and the Lions will be hosting games. That's okay. That's tradition. And what the NFL is doing is, as best as anyone can, trying to cobble together their schedule. I would look at college football as the real football example of decimation. I mean, you have in the classic game between Minnesota and Wisconsin, a game that started, a rivalry that started in 1890 and missed only one game, will not be playing because of COVID cases on the Minnesota side. Now, Wisconsin has missed so many games so far, they now won't get to the threshold to possibly qualify for a postseason in the Big Ten. It's just the reality.
Yeah. And what about college basketball? The season tipped off yesterday, but a story in the Chicago Tribune said it was a mess before it started. At least 40 Division I teams quarantining or have paused activity because of COVID-19.
Yeah. On the women's side, UConn has canceled its first, I think, four games because of positive tests. On the men's side, look, there are 362, I believe that's the right number, Division I college teams. So this just means more and more chances to have one or two positive tests that will cause a canceled game, and it's going to happen. One of the things that college basketball is doing, if you look at Uncasville, Connecticut, where the Mohegan Sun Casino is, they are branding themselves as the basketball bubble. It's Bubbleville, where all of these teams are going to be having 40 teams and 11 days of games because they figure we'll get all the teams in one place, we'll put conditions on the players, and we'll track their movement, and we'll test them, and this will be safe than playing just at normal schools. You wonder if it can be safe, and then you also think, you know, the players are doing whatever they can. The whole casino's open. You could go and play slot machines. So to some extent, it is a reflection of society, and I don't know exactly how seriously all of society is taking it. Maybe college basketball is taking it a little more seriously.
No. It's kind of dispiriting to talk with you on a weekly basis now because of COVID-19.
Thank you, Robin.
You're welcome. Yes. And we're going to kind of continue that because we want to mention Diego Maradona, the legendary soccer player from Argentina. He died yesterday at 60. He had heart issues. He scored one of the greatest goals ever weaving through English players. He also scored one of the worst. He touched the ball, right? And the ref didn't see it, but the whole world did. Just comment on his legacy.
Yeah, he punched in. It was called the rebranded afterwards to make it more palatable. The hand of God. He, you know, replays show him punching in the ball instead of heading in the ball. But his death has devastated Argentina. It's not so surprising, though he was 60. He had maybe even an adulthood long battle with cocaine use and was suspended several times. He had, within the last 8 days, been in and out of the hospital because of a brain clot. His lawyer says now he's looking into the ambulance response time. But all of Argentina is devastated by the news because they loved Maradona. And even with all his flaws, or maybe because of some of his flaws, he transcended sport. And you know what football / soccer means to the Argentines. So, yeah, they're devastated.
Well, anytime a sentence ends in transcended the sport, I mean, that's real. There is sorrow. Mike Pesca. Here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. And Mike, by the way, on this Thanksgiving, we thank you.
Oh, you're right back at you.
Thank you. And on behalf of hosts Tanya Mosley and Peter O'Dowd, I want to thank our colleagues who every day roll up their sleeves. Today, Karen Miller-Medzin, Cassidy Rosenblum, Alex Turk, Chico Theuri, Joel Ryan, Samantha Rafelson, Serena McMahon, Allison Hagen, Ellie Levine, Chris Ballman, Mike Moschetto, Max Lieben, Alex Ashlock, and the boss of us, Todd Mundt. You can salute our entire team at hereandnow.org. Just click on Meet the Staff. Build a little shrine there, as we would, because we just thank them and depend on them so much. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young. Oh, and we thank you. It makes no sense to do this without you. It's Here and Now.